Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did border regions in the antebellum South manage the complicated relationships between slaveholders and the people they claimed ownership of, free people of color living nearby, and abolitionists seeking to outlaw slavery altogether? Although the Civil War was still decades away in the summer of 1835, the city of Washington was already coping with the daily interactions between people with differing perspectives on human rights and dignity. And while some free blacks had earned significant wealth and social status, supporters of slavery did not hesitate to rise up and wreak havoc when provoked. Author Jefferson Morley is former Washington correspondent for Salon. He joins us to talk about his new book, Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
So even today, we tend to think of Washington, D.C. as a city of deep racial contradictions. Talk about the climate there in 1835.
Well, the striking thing about Washington in 1835, which I discovered in the course of writing Snowstorm in August, was this substantial free black population. In 1830, the census showed that Washington had a population of about 30,000 people. Of those, 12,000 were African American. And of the 12,000 African Americans, a slight majority were legally free. So less than half of the black people in Washington were slaves, even 30 years before the Civil War. So this created a unique situation, really, in the United States. Unlike pretty much any place else in the United States, slavery was visibly receding in the 1830s as this free black presence became more and more pronounced. The free blacks were moving in from the southern states as they obtained their freedom. They left the southern states. They wouldn't go all the way up to the north, to the free states. That was in a northern culture, an alien culture to them. They were southerners. So they flocked to Washington, where slavery was legal, but where the free black population had some room to make their way, to save money, to get jobs. So it created a really unique situation in the nation's capital at that time.
The city has sometimes been characterized as a sort of backwater for much of the 19th century. Your portrayal, though, is of a place that was considerably more sophisticated, even though it was, in some places, still under construction.
Yes. Before I wrote this book, if you had asked me what was Washington like in the 1830s, I would have said a sleepy southern town dominated by slave interests. And it wasn't that at all. It was more like a frontier town, a freewheeling place. Lots of gambling, lots of drinking, lots of whoring. Lots of race mixing. It's very different than what you might think of just off the top of your head.
One of the hottest spots by early 1835 was this restaurant run by a remarkable young man named Beverly Snow. Tell us about him, and then tell us about the establishment he built.
Well, Beverly Snow was one of the most he's the hero of Snowstorm in August, and he's one of the most remarkable characters I've ever run across. He was a mixed race man. He was from Lynchburg, Virginia, originally. When he was 30 years old, he bought his freedom from a friendly master and took the 3-day journey north to Washington to make his way. He was really emblematic of this growing free black community in Washington in the 1830s, and by sheer force of personality and charisma, really the leader. What he did, he was a cook. He had started out running an oyster house, oyster houses were kind of the fast food of the day. You know, you bought an oyster for a nickel, and that was kind of the working man's lunch. What Beverly Snow did was he took the idea of serving food, which was pretty primitive in those days, and gave it a whole new sophistication and that today we think of as obvious. You walk into a restaurant, you order what you want. Well, nobody did that in Washington in the 1830s. In the 1830s, there was a tavern or a hotel, and a boarding house, and they would say, at 11 o'clock, we're going to serve a beef stew. Come and get it. They put a pot in the middle of the table, and it was every man for himself. And if you were sitting at the corner, or if you were a child or a woman, you know, you were out of luck. What Beverly Snow did was he introduced the idea of table service. Now, you sit down at a table here. You don't have to grab the pot that everybody else is eating from. Order from our menu. We think of this now as so obvious as that nobody could have possibly invented that. But in fact, Beverly Snow, as far as I can tell, is the first person to introduce this idea of table and menu service in Washington. He's really the inventor of the Washington restaurant. And when he comes to town and opens up his restaurant called the Epicurean Eating House, he's a good businessman. He locates himself on the busiest corner in the nation's capital, which was the corner of 6th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. And his restaurant was an immediate hit. He served high-quality food, and he immediately attracted a clientele that included famous senators and congressmen, John Calhoun and Daniel Webster. And so he became kind of the restaurateur for the nation's political elite. So imagine that, a free black man prospering, flourishing even, in the heart of the slaveholding republic. That's who Beverly Snow was, and this book really tells the story of his life, which has never been told before.
So Snow is quite literally minding his own business that summer when a teenage boy, kept as a slave by the widow of the architect of the U.S. Capitol, was making it his business to try and educate himself. What role did the Philomathian Talking Society play in that?
The Philomathian. Well, you know, kind of the background to my book is really what happened when the anti-slavery movement first began to organize itself and to challenge slave power in the nation's capital. And this is really the larger theme of the book, is I argue that this is really when the ideological conflict that culminates in the Civil War starts. We think the Civil War started in April 1861 when shots were fired at Fort Sumter, and that's when the shooting began. But the ideological conflict between the organized forces that said we must abolish slavery and the organized forces that said we must preserve it, that actually begins in Washington in the 1830s. And so as anti-slavery publications start to circulate, there was a school teacher in Washington, a man named John Cook, a free black man, also from Virginia, who had organized a school for black children called the Union Seminary. And on the side, he ran what he called the Philomathian, which was a talking society, met covertly. And in it, he taught young black men who were enslaved how are you going to achieve your freedom? And he kind of laid down the rules for them. And he said, you got to learn to read and write. You can't drink. You can't use tobacco, and if you follow these things, this is how, you can get on the path to freedom. Arthur Bowen was a servant in the house of Anna Thornton. Like you said, she was a well-known widow. Her husband, William Thornton, had designed the Capitol. He was personal friends with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. She was very good friends with former President James Madison and John Quincy Adams. So she was very much from the elite of the society. Arthur Bowen was a servant in her house, and he was going to John Cook's talking society and learning this, both what was in store for him as a slave and also how he might attain his freedom. So after the talking society meets that day, and it's almost 177 years to the day, it was on August 4th, 1835, he goes home late at night, and he'd been drinking after attending this meeting.
So he broke that rule.
Yeah, and he stumbles into the room of Mrs. Thornton late at night, carrying an axe, and he's very drunk. He doesn't attempt to attack her at all. It's not even clear. He may have stumbled into her room by accident, but anyway. His mother, who was also a servant for Mrs. Thornton, was sleeping in that room with Mrs. Thornton. So the two women wake up, they scream, and his mother shoos him out of the house. Mrs. Thornton runs next door to get neighbors, and all the neighbors gather, and the story starts to spread. Mrs. Thornton has been attacked in her room by a slave with an axe, a kind of a sensational story. And so that story starts to spread very rapidly around the city of Washington. Now, among among the whites of the city, there was a lot of apprehension at this time about the possibility of slave rebellions. And so among whites, there was this feeling that Arthur Bowen's, this incident, was the first blow in what was going to be a slave insurrection. And so when Arthur Bowen turns himself in a few days later and says, "I don't remember anything," because he was too drunk, he's taken to the jail in the heart of town in Judiciary Square in Washington, and a mob surrounds the jail demanding that the jailers turn him over. They want to lynch him. The jail is about to be overrun by the mob when the Secretary of the Navy calls in the Marines, and a contingent of Marines marches down from Capitol Hill and surrounds the jail and keeps the mob at bay. And so the mob, frustrated now that they can't get their hands on Arthur Bowen, turns their fury on all the free blacks of Washington. And so this class of this growing group of free blacks, including people who had houses, and lots of property, the mob turns on them. And first and foremost, they turn on Beverly Snow because he's really the most prominent free black man in town. He knows that there's trouble afoot. He's got a lot of white friends, and so he manages to escape. But the mob trashes his restaurant and then proceeds to attack all of the free black people around Washington, their houses, the schools, the churches, any place where free black people, gathered and lived freely were going to be subject to the attack of the mob. So Snowstorm in August tells the story of this white riot, which happens in August of 1835, and its aftermath. And this incident is really, one reason I wrote the book was because this incident has been totally forgotten in the history of Washington. I've lived in Washington for 30 years now, and whenever I ask people, do they know the story about the riot of 1835, no one had ever heard of that story. Nobody who I met in Washington had ever heard that story. So that was really the reason that I wrote the book, was to bring the story of the remarkable story of Beverly Snow and the story of this riot to the attention of people today.
With this white mob forming outside the jail and then wreaking havoc in the free black quarters of the city, Jeff, was there just a contingent of white supremacists waiting for any excuse to act out?
Yes, there was. The context of this is the anti-slavery movement coming to Washington. Mm-hmm. Before about 1830, a lot of people didn't like slavery. They thought it was a bad idea. They knew that the brutality that it entailed, the unfairness. But there was this feeling, it'll go away someday, we know it's a bad idea, and so eventually, something will happen. It was kind of a vague and wishful impulse. Around 1830, both black people and white people started saying, it's not going to go away on its own. We need to abolish it now. And so this new movement arises with immediate emancipation as its goal, which is end slavery, give citizenship to black people, period. Let's do it now. A kind of radical demand, and that was what set, white defenders of slavery on edge and made them equally determined to preserve the slave system.
Jefferson Morley is with us. He's former Washington correspondent for Salon and author of the new book Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jefferson Morley. He is former Washington correspondent for Salon and author of the new book Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Jeff, on this night in August of 1835, the alarm goes out at Anna Thornton's house. Arthur Bowen is caught, and the man that will prosecute his case is none other than Francis Scott Key, who we know as the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, but was also DA for the city of Washington.
Yes, and one of the original things that drove me to write this book was when I learned that Francis Scott Key had been the district attorney for the city of Washington for 8 years, and found that really nobody I ever talked to had known that. I began to look into Key's political career, which post-dated his writing of the Star-Spangled Banner, and found a really remarkable story. Key had done the Washington thing, and he was a modern character in many ways. He became famous for the Star-Spangled Banner right away. The song was very popular as soon as he wrote it in 1814. And he parlayed his fame into a lucrative law practice in Washington. He was kind of the prototype of the modern Washington lawyer lobbyist. He had a lot of clients who did business with the federal government. He parlayed his lucrative law practice into political connections. He became very enamored with General Andrew Jackson, who won the presidency in 1828. And then he parlayed his political connections in the Jackson administration into a job. And Jackson appointed him as the district attorney for the city of Washington in 1833. Well, why did Andrew Jackson want Key in that job? Well, slavery was becoming a national political issue. And this new anti-slavery movement, a kind of insurgent, radical democratic movement, very much like the civil rights movement in our own time, or the anti-war movement, a movement with a controversial point of view, but one that was growing in popularity. And so as slavery becomes a national political issue, this anti-slavery movement says, okay, you know, we know that we're not going to be able to eliminate slavery in Georgia or Mississippi. You know, it's just that's the way of life down there, and there's nothing we can do about it. But we can abolish slavery in the District of Columbia because it's the capital of the whole nation. And if we're serious about the Bill of Rights, we're serious about the Declaration of Independence, we need to abolish slavery in the capital. Well, the pro-slavery forces were very alarmed at this because they understood that if slavery were abolished in the nation's capital, you know, slavery was going to be abolished in the rest of the country next, that this was a first step in the delegitimization and the abolition of slavery. So as the anti-slavery movement gains force and starts to push this agenda, the pro-slavery forces, led by President Jackson, begin to fight back. Well, Jackson wanted a reliable ally in City Hall in the District of Columbia who would defend the slave order in Washington, and he turned to his loyal political ally, Francis Scott Key, to do this. And, you know, this is the thing. People think the only important thing Francis Scott Key ever did in his life was write the lyrics to the Star-Spangled Banner. That is totally wrong. He did something else very important in his life. He suppressed the anti-slavery movement in the nation's capital. It was a very important political move at the time, and that's why Jackson gave him that job, because it was so important politically. So, and this has been totally forgotten here in Washington. There's a park dedicated to Key where he used to have his house in Georgetown. And in the park, there's exhibits devoted to him and his story of his life. And it says in the park, Francis Scott Key was active in anti-slavery causes. And that is exactly 100% wrong. Hmm. Francis Scott Key was active in suppressing anti-slavery causes. And this is a forgotten chapter in American history. That's one reason why I wrote the book, is it's very important that people understand that this history not be lost, and that the importance of Francis Scott Key really be understood. So Francis Scott Key was enforcing the slave order in Washington. That was his job. That's what President Jackson put him there for. And that is, in the aftermath of the riot, that's what he proceeds to do.
You mentioned the Bill of Rights a few minutes ago, Jeff, and this is interesting because the First Amendment was very much in existence at the time. One of the things that Francis Scott Key did was to sort of go after people who were distributing anti-slavery, abolitionist literature. How in the world was that legal?
Because the white man had a constitutional right to own property and people. Francis Scott Key was firmly believed that, and so he thought that the anti-slavery movement was unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court at the time agreed with him. This notion, Francis Scott Key never mentioned the word First Amendment. To him, anti-slavery literature was sedition. Hmm. It was an attempt to undermine the constitutional order. And what he wanted to do was drive out the anti-slavery forces in Washington. And he started by prosecuting a man named Benjamin Lundy, who's a character in my book also, a white man, an itinerant editor who had his own publication called The Genius of Universal Emancipation. And Ben Lundy was the first investigative reporter on slavery. And so, you know, at the time, the mainstream media of the day, I mean, they did not really talk about slavery much at all. They talk about slavery the way it was debated in Congress, mm-hmm. you know, when congressmen introduced this petition and that. But what Lundy did was he went out and reported stories like, you know, here was this man and he was whipped 100 times. This woman was raped. These people, their children were, you know, the families were broken up and the children were sold away. You know, and he named names. And this was quite shocking. And in fact, in 1833, Lundy told a story that was well known among black people in Washington, that a black woman had been chased by one of the constables who worked for Key on the bridge across the Potomac. And black people knew what that meant. If a policeman was chasing you, they were going to grab you and they were going to sell you into slavery. That's how the policeman made money on the side, was kidnapping free blacks and selling them into slavery. And so she ran away. She fell off the bridge. She fell into the Potomac, and she drowned. Her body was taken out, and nobody said anything. Well, Lundy wrote up the story. This is for a paper published in Washington. He named the name of the constable, and he said, if the district attorney isn't going to do something about it, then Congress should. Well, Francis Scott Key was furious when he read that, and he immediately charged Lundy with libel and brought him and his printer to trial. Well, Lundy knew what was in store. He was not going to get a fair trial in Washington, so he left town. But that's what Key was doing. He was trying to drive the anti-slavery forces out of Washington. And, you know, and while we think of Francis Scott Key, a kind of patriotic icon, you know, at the time, he was a very controversial guy, and the anti-slavery movement targeted him. And I came across one of their publications from the 1830s, a kind of, you know, a broadsheet, the kind of thing you would hand out to, mm-hmm. you know, political propaganda. And it was called Washington, Slave Market of America. And it was all about the slave trade in Washington. You know, while you had this free black population, you also had a slave trade going on with slave prisons, auctions of people, you know. And under this headline, Slave Market in America, which had pictures of people being whipped and sold, the headline was Land of the Free, Home of the Oppressed. You know, and the anti-slavery, you know, the American Anti-Slavery Society, they were needling Francis Scott Key. You know, you're a hypocrite, you know. You talk about the land of the free and the home of the brave, and look at what you're presiding over there in Washington. So Francis Scott Key, far from being a patriotic icon at that time, well, he was a patriotic icon at that time, but he was also a controversial figure and a target of the anti-slavery movement.
And consequently, another person that he went after was a northern abolitionist who moved to D.C., a guy named Reuben Crandall.
Yes. Well, so in the wake of the riot, Key is trying to reestablish order, and he wants to show that the anti-slavery movement will not be tolerated in Washington. So he had spies out in the community and in the post office, and they had seen these anti-slavery publications coming in, and they reported to Key and to the grand jury that there was this doctor in Georgetown, a white man, who had a trunk full of anti-slavery publications. And in fact, Reuben Crandall was a doctor and was an anti-slavery man and did have these publications in hand. So Key arrested him, just like he had charged Ben Lundy with seditious libel. He charged Reuben Crandall with seditious libel, too, and said he's trying to stir up a slave rebellion here in Washington, which was not true at all. He wasn't trying to stir up a slave rebellion, but he was intent on distributing anti-slavery material and educating people about what the realities of slavery. So Key wanted to suppress that, and in the spring of 1836, he brings Crandall to trial. And this is a nationwide story. This is a big, you know, political show trial, if you will. If you think about, you know, a big politically charged trial like, you know, Scooter Libby in the Bush administration, you know, a criminal case in Washington that attracts national attention because it has all kinds of political implications. Well, that was Francis Scott Key's case against Reuben Crandall. Congressmen came to the trial. You know, the galleries were packed with newspaper correspondents. Crowds gathered because they were intent on seeing this, the great confrontation between the famous Francis Scott Key and the anti-slavery movement. So the book really, this is a kind of culmination of the book where the arguments, the pro and anti-slavery arguments, are really put on in their purest form by Key on the pro-slavery side and by Crandall's lawyers on the anti-slavery side. So this was a very big deal in American politics in 1836.
So, Jeff, looking at all this from this point in history, it's sort of impossible to empathize with slaveholders. We should say, though, that they had reason not only to be angry about abolitionists among them, but they were frightened at the time. There had been slave revolts in Virginia that were still fresh on people's minds.
Well, you had 4 years earlier, you had Nat Turner's Rebellion in Southern Virginia. Where Nat Turner was a preacher, and he raised a band of slaves, and they killed probably about 55 white people in the settlements in Southampton County in Virginia before they were caught and dispersed, and eventually Turner was caught and hanged. So Nat Turner's Rebellion was a kind of 9/11 of its day. It was a shocking event. But the important thing to remember is that the effect of Nat Turner's Rebellion was for a lot of people to say, we need to deal with slavery now. And the impulse was not to suppress the anti-slavery forces, but to abolish slavery. And it's completely forgotten that in 1832, in the months after Nat Turner's Rebellion, the Virginia legislature debated a proposal for gradual emancipation of the slaves, which only failed by about 10 votes. Both of the major newspapers in Virginia came out in favor of gradual emancipation. So this mood of we need to do something about slavery and abolish it now is growing. I mean, I wouldn't say that the slave owners had reason to be angry. I mean, they were running a system of tyranny that was anti-American, and slavery should have been abolished. And it could have been abolished in the 1830s. At least there was a lot of debate about it. It wasn't like white Americans were unanimously in favor of slavery. Far from it. The anti-slavery movement was growing rapidly. And even people who had been in favor of slavery were starting to say, you know, no, we need to do something about this. But there was this backlash which said, no, we're not going to talk about slavery. We're not going to modify it. Forget it. And so in order to prevent the discussion of the issue, they resorted to suppressing the free speech of the anti-slavery movement. And Key was the point man of that effort.
How engaged was Key in this discussion about movement to take former slaves and move them back to Africa?
Key was very active in that. It was called the colonization movement. And until the anti-slavery movement came along, colonization was kind of the liberal alternative, if you will, to slavery. And this was the humanitarian alternative, which was, we'll abolish slavery, but since blacks and whites can never live together, this was the argument, the blacks should just go back to Africa. And Key was very active in this, raised a lot of money. He was one of the group's managers, the American Colonization Society. And he worked, you know, tirelessly on behalf of this effort. But in the course of, by that time in the 1830s, the American Colonization Society had been in existence for 15 years, and they had sent maybe 2,000 black people to a colony in what is now Liberia to set up their own black republic there. Well, in those same 15 years, the number of black people in slavery had increased by 400,000 people. So colonization was a gesture, but it was not a gesture that was doing anything about the reality of slavery in America. And as that realization sunk in, that's when the anti-slavery movement began to take off, and they said, look, this colonization thing is a charade. It's doing nothing about slavery. It's just a way of pretending to be against slavery, and we want some real action. So this also accounts for Key's vehemence against the anti-slavery movement, because he felt his own benevolence was being called into question, which it was.
Wasn't race rioting and destruction of property against the law in 1835?
It was, and this was the riot of 1835 was followed by deep consternation, humiliation, and recriminations in Washington. I mean, the city had been trashed. The city officials had lost control, and nothing like that had happened in Washington for 20 years since the British had invaded in 1814, when the British forces invaded the city during the War of 1812, and they burned the White House, and they burned the Library of Congress, and they sacked the Capitol. Except this time, it wasn't a foreign army that had done it. It was a bunch of drunken Americans. So there was a lot of bad feeling, and this is why the riot was forgotten, was because it was a shameful and embarrassing incident, and really nobody wanted to remember it. Key did put the leaders of the riot on trial as well, to show that the destruction of property would not be tolerated. But after securing their conviction, he then said to the court, we leave it up to the mercy of the court. So he was hoping for lenient treatment of the rioters.
Jefferson Morley is with us. He's a journalist who is former Washington correspondent for Salon. His new book is called Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former Salon Washington correspondent Jefferson Morley. His new book is called Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Jeff, plans are made to put both Reuben Crandall and Arthur Bowen on trial separately, of course. No plans on Key's part to ask for clemency on the part of the jury. But then there's this dramatic development in Arthur Bowen's case.
Yeah, so this sensational story that Mrs. Thornton had been attacked in her room by a slave with an axe spread all over town. It was the cause of the riot. Arthur was arrested. He was held in the jail, and in December, District Attorney Key brings Arthur Bowen to trial on a charge of attempted murder, and according to the statute of the day, the punishment for a slave charged with attempted murder was the death penalty. At the trial, though, Mrs. Thornton comes forward and says she testifies. And she says, I was very frightened when Arthur stumbled into my room, but he never raised the axe against me, and I know him. He's grown up in my house all of his life. I'm not afraid of him. He never intended to harm me. And she did not believe that he should even be charged. Well, Key ignored her testimony and got the testimony of other people and secured the conviction of Arthur Bowen. And in January of 1836, he was sentenced to hang. Within about a month, in February of 1835. So then Mrs. Thornton does something that was really quite unthinkable at the time, which was she publicly came to Arthur's defense and launched a petition drive among her influential and well-to-do friends, seeking a presidential pardon for him. So imagine this, this white woman has allegedly been attacked, and yet she's coming to the defense of the man who allegedly attacked her. Quite a brave thing and unexpected for her to do. She lost a lot of friends over this who did not believe that she should or could do this. But she regarded Arthur as, you know, as almost as a family to her. And in fact, when in her own diary, which I found in the Library of Congress, she, as his execution approaches, all she can think about is stories that she's heard from friends of hers, you know, who had lost a child unexpectedly. You know, and she knew a woman whose daughter was coming back from a trip and drowned in a steamboat accident. And she obsessively writes these stories in her diary. It was like Arthur was, you know, was her own child. And so she gets a petition, which is signed by senators, newspaper editors, and eventually she gets an audience with President Jackson. And in preparation for this meeting, she writes Jackson an 18-page letter, handwritten, in which she describes in intimate detail what happened that night and why she believed that Arthur should not be executed. And she's really begging Jackson, you know, please prevent this execution. The execution would be more horrible than the crime, is what she writes to President Jackson. And Key is not in favor of this. Key is in favor of Arthur's execution. But as Mrs. Thornton's case becomes known, public sentiment begins to change, and people begin to say, no, you know, whatever happened, this young man should not die for this. And really through single-handedly, through the force of her personality and her example, she changes public opinion in Washington, and it's pretty clear by the end that the newspaper coverage of her efforts becomes sympathetic, and people really want her to succeed. And so I won't give the story away, but it goes right down to the wire. Another thing you should understand, and this was new to me, was, you know, capital punishment was not popular at the time. Nobody had been executed in the District of Columbia at that point in more than 10 years, and the last person who had been executed was a murderer who had killed his neighbor in a dispute over nothing, and was a very unpopular and mean man, and there was no regret about his execution. But the idea that somebody was going to be hanged in the District of Columbia, a lot of people didn't like that. They did not like the idea, even if it was a slave, even a slave accused of murder. And so through her example, Mrs. Thornton really turns around public opinion and eventually manages to reach the heart of Andrew Jackson.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Remember, you can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak now to Rafe calling from Farmers Branch. Hi, Rafe.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Mr. Morley. Thanks
Hi,
for
Ray.
Taking my call.
Sure.
I was interested in whether or not Francis Scott Key, in hindsight and using today's judgment on slavery, ever changed his opinion again. In other words, turned another 180 degrees and went back and looked at slavery negatively prior to his death.
He did not. Key lived until 1841. He served as district attorney until 1840. He died in 1843. He did not change his mind. He entered into some correspondence with a leader of the anti-slavery movement in about 1838, and he reiterated his belief in colonization, his belief that blacks were not capable or worthy of citizenship, and that the anti-slavery movement was misguided and was not in the interests of black people. So Key pretty much stuck to his guns after the dramatic events of 1835 and 1836.
Were people who held different opinions about slavery as an institution able to have civil conversations at this point in our history, or was it simply a dividing line that would keep people apart?
It was a dividing line that kept people apart, and Key's prosecution of the abolitionists in Washington, I think, was part of this, which was it was not going to be a political debate in Washington, and the point of the pro-slavery forces was not to debate slavery and defend it. The point was to prevent the debate of slavery, and Key was in charge of enforcing that in the District of Columbia, and you had the same dynamic in Congress. Within a few months of the riot, of the snowstorm, of the book's title, Congress becomes the site of a fierce debate over slavery in December 1835, when the Northern congressmen begin to present petitions for the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia, and the Southern Senate, the Southern representatives, don't want to debate slavery. They don't want to come to the defense of slavery. They want no debate. And so this is when the infamous gag rule comes into effect. And what the Southern congressmen said, and they had a majority at that point, was these petitions for the abolition of slavery cannot even be introduced into Congress. We're not even going to talk about them. We're not going to accept them. We're not going to reject them. We are simply not, they are going to be excluded altogether. And so this is when the debate about slavery is joined in the Congress for the first time. So when I talk about this book is really about what happens when the anti-slavery movement starts, this is when slavery becomes a national political issue, and the conflict that would lead to the Civil War really starts in earnest. And those debates were quite heated and vehement in Congress. The anti-slavery forces were led by former President John Quincy Adams, who, after being defeated by President Jackson, returned to Congress, the only president who's ever done that. And Adams was a brilliant parliamentarian, and he kind of led the charge of the anti-slavery forces in the coming years. The Southerners had a majority in the Congress, and so the anti-slavery bloc was always outvoted, and the gag rule went into effect. Slavery was excluded from Congress, from debate for many years. But the anti-slavery movement now had a foothold in American politics, and while it was unpopular at the time, the popularity of the anti-slavery movement would continue to grow over the next 25 years until when Lincoln captures the White House, the anti-slavery forces had the upper hand for the first time.
What happened to Beverly Snow after all of this?
Well, Beverly Snow managed to escape the mob, and in the course of the rioting, he was accused of speaking coarsely of white women. This was the excuse given for attacking him, that he had made some rude remarks about white women. He went to Fredericksburg, Virginia, and turned himself in to the sheriff there and sent a public letter to the mayor of Washington and said, "I have done nothing wrong, and if anybody wants to accuse me of anything, they should step forward now. I urge them to do it." Nobody came forward. So Snow claimed his vindication. He returned to Washington to pay off his debts, but given his notoriety as the most successful and probably one of the wealthiest black men in Washington at the time, decided to leave. And like a lot of American blacks at that time, he decided to go to Canada. Canada was a British colony at the time, and the British Empire had abolished slavery in 1833. So Canada became a kind of, that was the land of the free. And Beverly Snow moved to Toronto, where he resumed his business. He opened up another restaurant called the Epicurean Recess and became a very successful restaurateur in Toronto lived there for many years and died a rich man.
Very much a story of our loss being Canada's gain in that
yes,
case.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Talk about digging into this story, and were there places where you came to a dead end and you had to sort of look for sources that you hadn't expected to turn to?
Yeah, in fact, you know, when I first started writing this book, I sort of despaired because I couldn't find anything on Beverly Snow. There were some anecdotes about him. He was a expansive and clever personality. He was a kind of a public entrepreneur, and so he made a mark wherever he went. And then I realized that he put a lot of advertisements in the newspapers in Washington, and I realized I needed to go back and find every one of them. And they turned out to be a very good window into his personality. He wrote them all himself. They were funny. They were clever. He made up little slogans. One of them was, his most popular one was, to advertise his restaurant, was "Health Made Cheap." And the idea was, you know, this food is not only tastes good, but it's good for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like an idea, you know, a century ahead of his time. He's selling health food. And so this was one reason why his restaurant was popular. It was unusual. It was entertaining. He kind of perfected the art of the fine dining experience. So that was a breakthrough to discover Beverly Snow. I found Anna Thornton's diary, which had a wealth of material. She wrote in her diary almost every day about what had happened to her. Not a very emotional diary, almost more like a journal. This happened, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But very revealing. She wrote down everything that she spent money on. So it really enabled me to recreate kind of daily life in Washington. But there were other places where, you know, you ran into a blank spot. The white rioters, I was trying to figure out, you know, who were the people in this mob, you know, and what motivated them. I was able to find out a little bit about some of the leaders of the mob because Key put them on trial. And they were not, they were not drunken rabble. The leader of the mob was a man whose father was a clerk in the Treasury Department. Another one was a justice of the peace. So these were respectable white men who led the mob. But it was very difficult to find out more about their interior lives because they didn't leave records or things. So, but all told, I mean, I wrote the book because I realized there really was enough to tell. I found a remarkable diary of a slave, of a black man named Michael Shiner, who was a carpenter, he was like a one-man CNN. He went all around Washington. Whenever anything big happened, there was Michael Shiner, and he wrote about it in his diary. I mean, his spelling wasn't very good, but he sure had a nose for the story. And so you could actually see these events as they unfolded in the eyes of a black man. And that was very unusual for the time. So when I realized that there really was enough to give a pretty good picture of daily life in Washington, that's when I realized I could write the book.
Jefferson Morley is former Washington correspondent for Salon and author of the new book Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, including the schedule for upcoming programs. You can also download our free daily podcast, all at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.